Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's finally starting to warm up a little bit in much of the country, and the job market is showing signs of thawing as well. But if your kid is out looking for ways to make some summer cash, well, things are not sunny at all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the 6th day of May. Today, the Labor Department said the unemployment rate edged up to 9% from 8.8 in March. That's based on a survey of households. But economists place more stock in the employer survey, and that showed 244,000 jobs added to payrolls last month. For private employers, it was the best hiring month in 5 years. Is the sun finally coming out? Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith.
The last couple years were really tight for John Scrofano. He's the CEO of Seattle-based startup NearlyWeds, a website that helps brides-to-be plan their nuptials. A major chunk of its income comes from ads, and Scrofano says those dried up.
We were tight and did not make a single hire in 2009 and the first three quarters of 2010.
But the advertisers are back. And now Scrofano is looking to fill four new positions. He says a lot of his fellow small business owners are doing the same.
They've just gotten to the point where they feel confident enough that things will return, that they're hiring because they're just so tired of having to do everything on such a small staff.
Since hitting a low point in February of last year, the U.S. economy has added 1.8 million jobs. Elliot Davila is an economist at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Most of the gains were concentrated in retail, trade, healthcare, amusements and gambling industries, the hotel industry.
While government jobs have declined, private companies are snapping up workers at the fastest pace in 5 years. Ken Goldstein is an economist with the Conference Board.
What this is telling us is that this recovery is now putting down some foundation. It's not going to be, great, but we certainly have a recovery underway.
There's still a ways to go. Roughly 8 million jobs were lost in the economic downturn. Goldstein says it will take several more years of this kind of slow and steady growth to gain them back. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There's certainly going to be a ways to go for young people, whether they're looking for a summer job to help pay next year's college fees or they're heading into the workforce right after high school. They face unemployment more than twice the national average. And it's even worse for minority teens. A quarter of Hispanic kids and 40% of blacks who are looking for a job cannot find one. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman went to a large urban high school in Portland, Oregon to take the employment pulse of the class of 2011.
What teenagers talk about most?
There's a bit of pre-graduation giddiness in the air at David Douglas High School. It's got 3,000 students, the majority on free or reduced lunch. Just a quarter of seniors are heading to college. Most of the rest will try to find work.
I haven't had a job in the summer before. I'm hoping with the high school diploma, I'll probably be able to find the job easier.
That's senior Jordy Montes, and he faces stiff odds. One in four Hispanic teens is unemployed. School counselor Deb Murray says Montes has it better than previous grads.
In the past 2 years, we have had very few part-time jobs. This year, there has actually been an uptick, mostly office and, of course, fast food.
I'm currently employed at a fast food place, Taco Bell.
Margarita Larez counts herself lucky.
I have a variety of friends who are constantly looking for jobs, especially at fast food places, and they constantly tell me, oh, hook me up with a job, but it's really difficult.
This summer, Larez will train to be a 911 operator. Economist Gary Burtless at the Brookings Institution says that could be a ticket out of minimum wage territory.
Young people who do not have an educational credential after high school have been in a very, very weak bargaining position by the time they reach their 30s.
Families can't offer much help. Many of these students' parents are laid off or on reduced hours. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The U.S. has given Pakistan billions of dollars in aid since 2002. After the death of Osama bin Laden, just a stone's throw away from Pakistan's military academy, some lawmakers are saying it is time to reevaluate that aid. We wondered what that means for Pakistan's lobbyist on retainer. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura has that story.
Pakistan pays Mark Siegel of Locke Lord Strategies nearly $1 million a year.
That's a lot of money, but veteran lobbyist Toby Moffitt isn't jealous.
I wouldn't want to have to go up to Capitol Hill if, in fact, bin Laden really was in that neighborhood for 5 or 6 years. I wouldn't want the job for any amount of money to have to go up there and explain why the Pakistanis didn't know it.
I asked Mark Siegel to give me his elevator pitch, but Pakistan's chief U.S. lobbyist took a pass. In a statement, the firm said it's continuing to assist President Zardari in working with the U.S. to combat global terrorism. Mark Tavlarides was Pakistan's lobbyist from 2005 to 2008. Here's his elevator pitch.
Al-Qaeda is still alive and well, and if it was up to them, they would execute terrorist operations against American interests. We need Pakistan to confront these threats. We cannot do it without them.
First, though, he says you have to get the story straight with the Pakistanis. Then,
give the embassy an unvarnished, honest readout
based on what the Pakistani military, administration officials, and lawmakers are saying. But Toby Moffitt thinks it's going to be tough to convince Congress that the Pakistani government didn't know that bin Laden was hiding in plain sight.
I wouldn't even want to try to defend that one.
Bill Allison with the Sunlight Foundation, a lobbying watchdog, says Siegel could enlist more lobbyists and consultants, hoping more Pakistani money will keep the aid flowing. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Wall Street broke its 4-day losing streak today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Started off with news we've been waiting 10 years to hear. Bookend that with a good but not great jobs report. And what do you have? Well, here for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond, we have Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Cardiff Garcia from the Financial Times Alphaville blog. Hey, guys.
Hi, Tess.
Hey, Tess.
So I got to ask, the U.S. finally got Osama bin Laden. And while there was a slight consumer confidence bump, the stock market did not really react. Any surprise there?
You know, the market's funny with geopolitical turmoil. It's almost like it very rarely impacts the markets. And I think this news, however big and enormous it was, it's just not as big an event for the market. But it is a little surprising because the one thing the market does like is certainty. So
exactly.
This was a very certain event.
Cardiff?
I don't want to minimize the sort of historical or political importance of a story like this, but I think it's really quite negligible in economic terms. And it was kind of amusing right after it happened to see a lot of economists kind of try to jump out there with their opinions about whether or not this means there's more or less risk in the world. I mean, I can't imagine anything that economists are less qualified to do than that. Actually, I can, but anyways, you get the point.
That doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah. One way to think about this, too, though, is just to use common sense. So I can't imagine, for instance, a consumer saying, well, I'm pretty down on the economy generally, but Osama bin Laden's dead, so now I feel pretty good and I'm going to go buy things that I wouldn't otherwise buy. Or, you know, business is changing the way they're doing things. So, you know, it's obviously a huge event, but I think the impact on the economy is really quite marginal.
Well, let's slide over to something that is not negligible when it comes to the economy, and that's commodities. Boy, a strange week, a bad week. Silver plunged, for one thing. Oil went up and then it went down. Is some of this a long overdue correction? Is that what we're hearing at this point, Lee?
It's been a truism in the markets the past 2 years that commodity prices are just going up. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of this is just what tends to happen every now and then when a market gets overheated, which is psychology takes over, contagion takes over. Some investors start selling off and then it just sort of spreads. But I don't think this is something to really worry about. I think if you look at the global long-term trends in commodities, the fundamentals that drive the prices of commodities haven't changed.
Yeah, and keep in mind also that a lot of people use commodities as a kind of proxy for the prospects of emerging markets growth. And so, yeah, there have been some signs that it might slow down pretty soon, but not anything that would sort of lead to the kind of precipitous fall that we saw yesterday. So I think it's pretty hard to pinpoint any one specific thing, but sometimes the markets just, you know, get crazy like that.
All right. Well, let's jump to today's news. We have the monthly jobs report. We heard about that up top of the show. Some analysts saying it's a good report, more jobs added. Others saying, well, yeah, but the jobless rate bumped back up. What do you make of it?
It was sort of a mixed bag. I mean, I think on the whole, it's not
great and rosy, but it's a real step in the right direction, and we just need to have it sustained, and we need to see companies starting to hire, which doesn't really seem to be happening anytime soon.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, more than anything, I thought it was a confusing report. At least it does confirm that the private sector job gains we saw in the last couple of months weren't a complete fluke. But, the bottom line is still the same. The labor market is sort of steadily improving, but given the precipice from which it's trying to climb out of, it's still completely inadequate.
All right. So it was a big news week. Can we get some sort of psychological evaluation here? How are we doing? Are we dancing on tables? Are we walking through the park on a sunny day? What?
You first.
That's a tough one. I think we're slowly muddling along. I think everything's moving in the right direction. It's just taking a long time. And that's how I felt for a while now.
Yeah, I think the recovery for the most part looks pretty sputtering right now. But more than anything, I think this is an economic environment that's dominated by uncertainty. Right now, people just don't know what the future holds to an extent that, you know, we haven't seen in a long time.
And the only exception to all of that is Apple and Facebook.
There you go.
All right. Well, we are happy to call both of you friends. Lee Gallagher of Fortune Magazine, Cardiff Garcia of the Financial Times. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tess.
Thanks, Tess. Take care.
Art institutions did not have an easy go of it during the recession. A recent survey from the American Association of Museums showed more than 70% of them under financial stress. Government support is down, and so is investment income. But one museum will not be joining the ranks of the struggling. This week, the Walton Family Foundation gave $800 million cash to the new art museum being built by Walmart heiress Alice Walton. And that is a record, Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
Walmart is known for its killer low prices. But in the art world, the heiress to the chain has another reputation, big spender. Alice Walton has outbid many an established gallery for key pieces she wants to show off at her museum called Crystal Bridges, expected to open on Veterans Day. Crystal Bridges' Rod Bigelow says there will be 8 galleries on the wooded site, just a short walk from Walmart's Bentonville headquarters.
The work is all American, and it does span 5 centuries, so it will include everything from pre-colonial work to contemporary.
Exactly what's in most of the collection of 400 pieces, though, hasn't been made public yet. Lee Rosenbaum blogs as Culture Girl at artsjournal.com.
There's been a kind of striptease in revealing just a few works at a time. And the real test about whether this is going to be truly a distinguished museum is when we finally learn whether it has truly a distinguished collection.
Rosenbaum says the size of this gift may spur other art benefactors to give lavishly, too, if only to compete with Crystal Bridges. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Coming up, the makers of Lay's potato chips are developing snacks that have less salt. But does that mean they're healthy?
This is a slightly better for you option, a good choice. When what you really want is you want people eating foods that are unprocessed as possible.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets ended a 4-day slump on that positive jobs news. The Dow climbed 54 points, 0.4% to end at 12,638. The Nasdaq rolled up 12 points, also 0.4% to finish at 2827. And the S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.3% to close at 1340. For the week, the Dow lost 1.3%. The Nasdaq fell 1.6%. And the S&P 500 parted with 1.7%. Kraft Foods bulked up 2% today after posting strong first quarter sales and profits that topped expectations. The food giant was able to raise prices and cut costs enough to absorb those rising prices for commodities. Caterpillar plowed ahead almost 1%, and DuPont gained 1.4%. Overseas European markets marched up 1% or more across the board. The 10-year T-note stood still with a yield at 3.15%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The United Nations Committee Against Torture convenes its 46th session in Geneva. Did your mother ever tell you that if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all? Time to put it into practice. National Etiquette Week begins. And she's known for her portrayal of Murphy Brown and other roles. Emmy Award-winning actress Candice Bergen turns 65. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. When putting a roof over your head, you generally have two choices, you rent or you buy. But the housing bust has created a hybrid of the two. People who bought a home, but at some point stopped paying the mortgage, either because they can't or because they decided not to. Yet they are still living in the house. Michael Feroli has been tracking what's called squatter rent, and he says it's actually helping the economy to the tune of $50 billion. He's chief U.S. economist at JPMorgan Chase, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks.
So first of all, can you give us a sense of how prevalent this is? What are the numbers on people who are squatting in their own homes?
Well, right now you're looking at about 8% of mortgages outstanding are past due, and there are about 44 million mortgages out there. So you're talking about a pretty significant number of people who right now are not paying their mortgage.
Wow. So how did you come up with the estimate of a $50 billion impact here?
Right. So there's about $10 trillion in mortgage debt owed by the household sector. So you're looking at about $800 billion of mortgages, which are past due, average interest rate of about 6% or a little above. Most of those mortgages, of course, are in the early stage when it's in mostly interest that you're paying. So 6% on a little over $800 billion comes out to about $50 billion per year that are free for other purposes.
Wow, that is a chunk of change. So how is that money being spent instead? What's it going toward?
Well, I mean, no one knows for sure, of course, but presumably these are households that are under a lot of financial stress and presumably are going into necessities. We're not talking about households that have a lot of disposable income and are spending on luxuries. So, of course, there are a lot of, at least some anecdotes that I've heard of that happening, people being kind of strategic in defaulting. But I would suspect that, you know, the vast majority is people who are may have lost a job or are otherwise financially in difficult straits.
Yeah. But so actually what we're saying here is that mortgage defaults are actually contributing to the economic recovery, potentially.
Well, I think it's one of the shock absorbers that's, you know, kind of built into the economy, which is to say that when things turn down, there were some offsets, and this is one of those. And I think as the economy improves and people are able to pay their mortgages and as the job market, you know, continues to heal like we saw in the data this morning, those people who are gaining jobs, maybe part of the income they get is going to go back into paying their mortgage. So it probably plays out a little bit in both directions.
Well, of course, whenever we talk about strategic defaults or people squatting in their own homes, not paying their mortgages, you get, you know, people who question the ethics of that. So who gets hurt when these people do stay in their homes without paying the rent? Obviously, the banks, mortgage servicers, but does it have a ripple effect for the rest of us?
Well, I mean, to the extent you've seen a lot of bank failures throughout the country, particularly a lot of smaller banks, community banks, when that happens, that obviously hurts those communities, and the FDIC is left to pick up the tab. And so directly or indirectly, the taxpayer also takes some burden. And, you know, an increasing share of these mortgages are ones that the GSEs are on the hook for in one form or another.
That's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Exactly. And so those being now at least in part, taxpayer-supported. The taxpayer does bear some of the burden here.
All right. Michael Feroli is Chief U.S. Economist at J.P. Morgan Chase in New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Journal of the American Medical Association just came out with a study that says people who eat less salt tend to die of heart disease faster. That, of course, goes against decades of research suggesting the opposite. Health experts at Harvard say the study is flawed and should be ignored. But what cannot be ignored is that we love salt and we eat a lot of it, especially in processed foods like chips and baked goods. PepsiCo claims to have developed a salt that tastes just like salt, but it's not as bad for you. We asked Sean Cole to visit PepsiCo headquarters, and we absolutely insisted that he bring an appetite.
Hello, sir.
How you doing?
How are you?
Nice meeting you.
What is your name again?
Greg Yep.
Greg Yep is PepsiCo's Senior VP of Research and Development. We met up in a boardroom at the company's headquarters in Purchase, New York.
This is great. We have water. And we have chips.
Bags of test chips from the lab, and I'm going to taste them. The first bag is just classic Lay's with a third of the salt removed. The second bag is the same, but it's dusted with a PepsiCo invention called crystal salt. It's a more soluble form of sodium chloride. Because Yep says with normal chips,
a lot of the salt is not actually tasted. It doesn't dissolve as efficiently on your tongue. When we design crystal salt, you actually taste more on your tongue, so you can use less, and it gives you a more salty flavor.
So the idea is the crystal salt chips should taste saltier, more like full salt classic Lay's. Because for one thing, crystal salt is a lot finer than regular salt. Yep brought along these petri dishes of comparative samples.
Here's what you would see in Lay's Classic.
This looks like just table salt, like what I would see in a shaker.
But this is actually table salt.
Oh, no kidding. So this is actually, the table salt's more powdery than the Lay's.
And this is what we call our crystal salt technology.
This is like cocaine.
No.
Okay, it's like confectioner's sugar. Also, PepsiCo changed the shape of the grain in some proprietary patent-pending way. Anyhow, enough science. I started with the plain old Lay's reduced salt chip.
Okay, tastes like a potato chip.
And then sampled a reduced salt chip with crystal salt. And then I went back and forth.
I'm going to get fat.
And maybe it's because it wasn't a blind test, but I couldn't really tell the difference. Moreover, PepsiCo says sales of full salt classic Lay's are doing fine. So why go to all this trouble?
That's what the consumers are increasingly asking for. One, I want healthier products. Two, I don't want to compromise on the taste.
Mehmood Khan is chief scientific officer at PepsiCo. He's also an endocrinologist. He used to work at the Mayo Clinic. He says the crystal salt initiative is part of a larger goal.
We've made commitments to lower the salt content by 25%, lower saturated fat, and lower sugar across our portfolio in our top markets. It makes good business sense. It makes good consumer health and wellness sense. Healthy businesses exist in societies that are healthy.
We're talking about potato chips here. We're not talking about a health food.
Marion Nessel teaches nutrition and public health at NYU.
And the philosophical question that you have to ask about these products is a slightly better for you option, a good choice. When what you really want is you want people eating foods that are unprocessed as possible.
Professor Nessel told me sure, a third less sodium in a bag of chips is positive. But she also says maintaining the same salt taste as regular Lay's defeats the purpose.
Because the purpose of the reducing the amount of sodium, besides the health effect, is to try to get people's salt preferences lower so that the amount of salt that's in products at a much lower level will taste salty to the people who are tasting it.
Case in point, Nessel lowered her salt intake years ago. Everything tastes too salty to her. Conversely, my taste buds are apparently shot. I brought some classic Lay's with me to the lab and couldn't tell the difference between them and anything else I tasted.
Very yummy, but they only taste saltier.
I should mention that a bag of classic Lay's has 170 milligrams of salt per 1 ounce serving, which is not dramatically high. But I bet you can't eat just 1 ounce. In New York, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And for our final note today, a look back at the week's news, the stories that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Newnham, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Jennifer Collins, reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about the Home Alone house.
From the movie?
Yeah, actually, the Home Alone house is up for sale. $2.4 million. You could have it yourself.
That's probably what the movie cost back in the 80s.
No, I mean, the movie grossed $500 million, so it's really a bargain.
If you think about it that way, why are they selling it?
Well, apparently the couple that owns it, their kids have moved away, and, well, they're feeling like a little home alone.
Avishai Artsy, assistant producer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about?
Well, recently, Turkish police officers were going to people's doors dressed as doctors and handing out heart medication.
Why would they do that?
Well, apparently there have been a lot of confidence crimes in Turkey recently, and they're trying to educate the public about how gullible they are. And they're right. 86 out of 100 households took the pills and swallowed them right away.
Isn't this just going to make people mistrust the police for doing this stuff to them? Officer, I would have pulled over sooner, but I wasn't sure if you were my optometrist or not.
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, this one comes from the European Union, where the fisheries chief has announced they're going to pay fishermen to catch plastic rather than catching fish.
Because there's a lot of pollution?
There's that, but it's also an incentive to keep them from overfishing.
So that they don't endanger depleted fish stocks or something.
That's exactly it.
And you know, fish sandwiches at fast food places have tasted like plastic for decades, so who's going to notice?
And you can hear more of what Brendan and Rico have to offer on their podcast, The Dinner Party Download. You can find a link to it at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 54 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq rolled up 12 points, also 0.4%. And the S&P 500 gained 5 points, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is JJ Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, relocating the family overseas for work can be tough, but now there's help.
This time was the first time that we actually had someone come to the house and talk to us about what it would be like to live in a new country.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Kai will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.